This is the Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how an individualized diet can help you if you have irritable bowel syndrome much better than a placebo. Who says? Yale University researchers say, and we'll share that. Then, for those of you who've been using different cosmetics or beauty care products that contain a particular acid, hyaluronic acid, there's new information showing it actually works. Toho University, Ohashi Medical Center in Japan. Also, antioxidant treatment could halt neurodegeneration in early Parkinson's disease, Northwestern University. And exercise can make cells healthier, promoting a longer life, University of Virginia. As well as biochemists discovered what makes olive oil help with weight loss, Virginia Tech University, and a whole lot more. Then we'll go to the latest on the environment, and then a couple commentaries. One commentary will deal specifically with the abuses of history and why we need to understand history from a different perspective, a more honest perspective. Chris Hedges from Truthdig. Also continuing our commentary yesterday about silencing of dissent. I'll share some of my own thoughts on that and how you deal with it and what it means. And on a couple of these, I'll take talkbacks. Plus, have you noticed that when you go to buy almost anything today, you don't have the selection you once did, certainly not 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So John Oliver is giving us his perspective on the idea of monopolies. And they're not being stopped. Almost all monopolies are allowed. What does it mean for you and I? Is a monopoly a good thing or a bad thing? Does it allow greater variety? A greater opportunity for challenging if something's wrong? What happened to competition in the marketplace? Laissez-faire. Well, we really don't have competition in the marketplace today because we're getting to where we only have one or two markets, and the people in it maintain all the control over what we purchase, like an airline. How few airlines are today? There are only four. There once was 20. So, and the media used to have over 1,000 media outlets. Now, 90% of the media is controlled by 7 organizations. And almost all their board of directors, you have people sitting from Big Pharma, Wall Street, and other industries. And they might can sit on 5, 10, 20 different boards. In fact, you can make a very big living in the United States just by sitting on a board of directors. So, what's that mean for us? Because we're not invited to sit on any board. And we're not in that area where we can create monopolies. So we have to live by a different set of rules. So we have a lot to share today. And I always try to select themes that will allow a worldwide audience. Please remember, some of you have been listening for a long time on a daily basis to WMCA. And before WMCA, there was a Balkan Echo Radio, WHBI. And then after that, there was ABC Network for 12 years, and WABC, and WOR, WVD. All told, 45 years. On WBAI, 41 years, and counting. So we don't just have a local audience now. Our audience is listening from every part of the world. But here are the people who are listening. People who want the truth and no longer trust the official organs for providing that insight. So we have people that used to watch television or read the New York Times who today realize that on specific topics by different journalists, there is selective bias. So we don't have that. So we're sharing a lot with you today, and we're going to start with health. We have a lot of Americans who have irritable bowel, and irritable bowel syndrome is really difficult. It's very painful. And sometimes people don't experience a lot of symptoms, and therefore they think that they're not having a problem. It's a disorder that can cause chronic abdominal pain and gas and diarrhea and constipation. And many patients with irritable bowel syndrome try diets based upon blood tests that claim to identify foods that trigger their symptoms. I have not seen good evidence to convince me that there is any legitimacy in that. The majority of these food intolerance tests have not been validated, and so a group of scientists from Yale University conducted a double-blind, randomized clinical trial on patients with irritable bowel. And for each individual, they did a very comprehensive immune cell activation response and ask them about their diets, etc. And after several weeks on the individualized diets, participants were assessed for their symptoms and quality of life. And the research team found that while both sets of participants experienced improvement, the individual on specific diets given to them based upon their own individual needs fared much, much better overall in terms of symptom severity. Quote, "We didn't expect the results like this. The people who consumed the diet consistent with the test did significantly better than those that were on a sham diet." So here is the takeaway message, and this was published in the British Medical Journal Open Gastroenterology. You should always try with any serious health problem or chronic health problem to find the therapist that is patient, smart, understands what your particular biochemistry is, your personality, and then try to select a therapy program that harmonizes with that. Not just, oh, okay, my next patient is a heart patient, you're all the same. No, you're not. So each individual in America should be treated as if they were an individual, and you'll get better results. For those of you who are wanting to get rid of some of the wrinkles in your skin, there are all kinds of creams out there. Most don't work. Most are just hype. But there's a particular nutrient, and that nutrient is hyaluronic acid, and it can actually improve skin and reduce wrinkles, according to this new study. This was a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial on a group of adults, and they got 120 milligrams per day of the ingredient, and it led to improvement in skin suppleness. Quote, "This study showed that the oral ingestion of this particular acid for 12 weeks suppresses wrinkles and improves the skin's luster and suppleness in people." So it worked, at least if you're getting that ingredient. That tends to be an expensive ingredient. That's why most people don't use it. For those of you who know anyone with Parkinson's, it's always important to really detoxify before you try to rejuvenate. A lot of people bypass detoxification, go right into rejuvenation therapies, and they don't get the same response. I remember a brain support group we did. We had people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, and multiple sclerosis, even myasthenia gravis. And of the 26 participants, 20 stuck with the whole protocol for a year and a half, and 90% had either substantial improvement or complete reversal of their conditions. And one of those was a gentleman. He was an engineer by trade. He was African American. He was 70 years of age. His name was Thomas. And fortunately, I filmed him. I film all the people now at the beginning, the entrance of a health support group. And they just talk about what they're there for. And then I film them at exit on the last day. Why? Because you have no idea what it's like when you've worked for a year or 2 years with a person with a serious illness. You help them, they get their health back, they go back to their original physician, and the physician says, well, I must have made a mistake in your original diagnosis because you don't have this and it couldn't have been reversed any other way, so you really didn't have terminal cancer, in which case I say, okay, then thank you for the massive lawsuit because you were treating me and you diagnosed me and you operated on me and you gave me radiation and you gave me chemotherapy and then it came back and you couldn't stop it and I was in the hospital and here's my 27 different visits. So you and all the oncologists, the nurses, the hospital administrations, you just met yourself a $100 million lawsuit because you were practicing malpractice. That's on the one hand. On the other is you can acknowledge, oh, I forgot Sloan Kettering doesn't do this. You can acknowledge there's actually some knowledge in the universe that you gifted little angels sitting on the end of a hypodermic needle filled with chemotherapy. You actually don't know everything there is to know. Heaven forbid you ever make any decision from Sloan Kettering based upon humility and openness. Wow. And so after thousands upon tens of thousands of people improving or reversing where their doctors couldn't, I said, okay, from now on, we have a video. So you take the video and you pop it in and you show them. Here I am on day one. Here I am on day 30. It says more about the inability of a highly trained and disciplined mind to be open to anything new that challenges its support system, its power over and a part of a paradigm, than it does for the therapy itself. Most therapies are relatively straightforward and simple, not complicated, not difficult to understand. I'm going to share now a little aside because it also talks about it addresses the issue of what I started on yesterday, which was censorship, of which we have a lot of in our society. I mean, a lot. Last night I had an opportunity to watch a film before it's released. The director sent me a copy to get my feedback, and today I passed on that feedback. It's about a Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and the whole film is about his critics condemning him and him showing how he's dealing with that criticism. I remember the very first time I spoke with Andrew Wakefield, and I had done as much homework as I could without talking with him, and then I spent an hour or two talking with him. I said, you realize if you try to win in the court, you'll lose. You have to win in the court of public opinion, and for that, you better show what's wrong with the case against you and find the hidden motive. And as an investigative reporter who's broken over 300 original stories, going clear back to caveat emptor, it's exposing the weakness, the deception, or out-and-out lies of your opponent. And then people realize, gee whiz, maybe I should reevaluate who's really guilty here. Because in my career, I've seen a lot of good doctors having their careers destroyed because they were actually curing patients. And their medical paradigm says you can cure a patient, absolutely, as long as you're doing it with the existing protocols. But what if the existing protocols actually hurt a patient rather than help them? You're still going to be rewarded, but don't go outside of that. And these doctors went outside of it and cured patients with different conditions. And they all suffered for it. They paid for it. Janice Keller Phelps, who is the president of the Oregon Pediatrician Society, said that at every one of their monthly meetings, there would be a bar set up and all the liquor supplied by the formula makers. And every month, she would have cases of formula free delivered to her office for her patients, to get them on formula instead of breastfeeding. But when the day came that she opened her eyes to the power of midwifery and how bad formula was compared to breast milk, and she became an advocate for breastfeeding and nurse midwifery. She was attacked. She ultimately lost her license, and when I spoke to her, she was painting houses somewhere, and she came to New York to visit to tell me her story. And some of you may remember I brought her on the air, and we talked about what it was to have a very positive and successful career, raising your family, and then one day your whole world is shattered by doing good for people, not realizing when you're doing good for someone and it doesn't affect anyone else, fine, no one cares. You do good, but that costs someone else their reputation or costs someone else money, then it's not going to go unchallenged. So when I watched this film last night by this particular director, and it was on Andrew Wakefield, it was not an impressive film on any level. There's nothing new added. But what was clear was he was fighting the wrong fight. He was spending millions of dollars on lawyers and appeal, but he didn't go to the media. He didn't go to the American public. He should have put all of his energy in a different direction, also exposing Rupert Murdoch, his son, the connection of the son sitting on the board of the MMR vaccine maker in England, and how that could have impacted the hearings against him. Be that as it may, he is now a man who will forever be known as Wakefield, meaning doctors won't try anything with you because they don't want to be Wakefielded, meaning they don't want to have their reputation destroyed. And that's what happens. Now, that's part of what it means to dissent in medicine. I also remember how many times Linus Pauling, the great Nobel Prize winning, twice won the Nobel Prize. The only American ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes. Otto Warburg won twice, but he was shared one. And we were sitting one night up at the Institute of Applied Biology, and he was interested in some of the research I was doing, especially with nutrients and juicing and extending the life of lab rats. And I asked him a question. I said, do you know how many papers you published? I don't know, over 400. How many? I'm not sure of. And you're arguably one of the finest chemists in American history. After all, one of your Nobel Prizes was in chemistry. And you've done a lot of major discoveries. How did it feel the first time you started having your reputation challenged, then a whole systematic attack against you after you showed that you and Dr. Ewan Cameron at the Vale of Leven Hospital in Scotland were able to reverse cancer in a certain group of terminally ill cancer patients? That should have been something that people were excited by when you were using high-dose vitamin C to the end of life of a patient. But instead, they did a fake study that did not replicate your protocol, and that could not have been unintentional, and then said that, well, this shows that your study didn't matter, and therefore, you know, you're not a good scientist. And he told me that after that, he couldn't get any support in the media at all. There was just no one wanted to hear his story. Now, he also was a big believer that you should take vitamin C every day. He took between 15,000 to 20,000 milligrams a day. And indeed, that's very important. But dissent should be advocated. Dissent should be respected. We should have open forums where people have different points of view. If you don't believe we should take a lot of vitamin C, if you don't believe vitamin C helps cancer, if you don't believe cranberry juice helps with interstitial cystitis, if you don't believe that magnetic therapy helps with depression, if you don't believe that chiropractic helps with opening energy pathways in the spine and reconnecting the spine's energy flow with subluxation, then debate it. Don't denigrate the person. Debate it. Have open debates. Let the public decide. Present your best effort. But we're faced now with something different. Let me give you an example. The night before last, I watched a short film, only 12 minutes long. It was by Joan Shenton, who I've had on this program. I filmed Joan for one of my earlier documentaries, one of the five I did on AIDS. And I remember at the time I was doing this, and Joan and I were talking, she wanted to see, would I loan her some footage to use one of her documentaries I'd done of Kerry Mullis. I said, sure. He won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR, polymerase chain reaction, which is used in AIDS diagnosis. And at that time, as you will see, you can go up on YouTube and there's Dr. Kerry Mullis and I walking on the beach and sitting in his little house across from the beach talking about why everything that we were told about AIDS originally, none of it was proven. And he couldn't get any facts from Robert Galloway or other people. He would later, years later, he would not be as outspoken nor as forthright on the issue. I don't know what he feels about this today. But he went on the record then. He was being filmed. He knew he was being filmed. And because we spent hours filming him. And that's just one late 18-minute snippet. And here I am speaking with Joan Shenton from England, who is an award-winning reporter. And she was trying to get interviews with people. She couldn't, so I gave her the film footage I have, which I've done, by the way, for lots of filmmakers. And sitting in the room at the Tri-State Healing Center were 24 people. Yes, it was at night, and we're filming in that room because I wanted to show that here were people who were having a normal conversation about their lives because they actually had lives and were optimistic. These were long-term survivors. Some had originally taken AZT but got so deadly ill they stopped. Others saw their partners take AZT and die. And there was a gentleman there, and he was taking a big drip, 200,000 milligrams. And he told us a story. He said that he had come from California, and he was one of the early diagnosed people with HIV. And he was encouraged to join one of the support groups, and one of the largest was in Los Angeles, and he did. And he went every week, as many times as he could, to the support meeting. But what he noticed was that there were a group of people there who were advocating, and he said, adamantly advocating, take the drug, AZT, and you get a chance to live. If you don't, you could be dead in months. And there was just something he said intuitively that said, let me keep going to the meetings, but I'm eating at a health food restaurant, I'm drinking my juices, I'm running on the beach, I'm lifting weights, I'm feeling good. So I looked up the side effects of AZT, and man, the side effects of AZT are virtually indistinguishable from AIDS symptoms. So how do you know that you're dying of AIDS versus dying of the side effects of the drug, AZT? And so he said he just didn't tell anyone he wasn't taking the drugs. So everyone assumed he was. And over the next 2 years, get this, he said that over 2,000 people in his health support groups, AIDS groups, died. He said in one group there was no one left. He was the only one. All of them were taking AZT. All of them were doing what they were told. And that's when he said, there's something terribly wrong if I'm the only one alive. He came to New York, came to the center, and now he's with a whole group, 1,200 people I work with AIDS, and worked every day with them, never charged them a penny, and they're getting their drips, and every half hour they're getting different fresh-made juices, and they're getting immune supplements, they're getting everything, and they're making major progress. But do you think any of their information ever got into the mainstream media? Not once. Not once. It did get into the black media. Absolutely. In fact, right across America, you could talk about AIDS, natural treatments, and what we were doing would pop up, and Arthur Ashe and Stokely Carmichael, who I knew very well, and many of the black doctors, and Nation of Islam, all that came up because it was all going on at the same time and everyone was coming there. But in the Caucasian media, not a word, not a syllable. That's censorship. Because I sent press releases out 7,000 and not a word. I even remember this. Maybe someone in this audience was there. If you were there, please call in. I'd like to hear your perspective on it. I was doing a lecture at the Roosevelt Hotel Grand Ballroom. It was packed. In fact, it was standing room only, much like the lecture I did 2 weeks ago at the vegan conference here. And I want to thank you all for being patient. I also want to let the people know who were outside. There were 300 people, I was told, outside who couldn't get in, and they turned a speaker on outside, so at least you could hear the lecture inside. And so thank you for being patient, because no one expected the whole, you know, place to be full and 500 or 600 people standing. In any case, it was the same way at the Roosevelt. And a reporter was there to do a story on me. And I said, look, I'm not the story. Here's a room full of people. Why don't you ask them what they had, what treatment they had, and how they're doing today? Okay. Well, no, that's not the story. I said, that is the story. So I said, how many people in this room have had end-stage cancer and today are healthy, alive, with or without the cancer? All these hands went up. How many improved with Parkinson's? Hands went up. How many improved? And all these people's hands. We're talking about thousands of people, by the way. The reporter never asked a single person. I said to the person in front with a microphone, I said, I'm going to be holding a press conference this coming week where we're going to bring 100 people who had full-blown AIDS, not just HIV positive, but otherwise asymptomatic or healthy, with their doctors and their medical records and a team of scientists who have evaluated these. It's taken a year to put this together. Why don't you then come if you want a really important story? Because this is the first time that long-term survivors with no disease at all in their body can tell you what they did without the drugs. Would you come? Well, I don't know. Oh, but if I was a drug maker, and if I had a new experimental drug, oh, you'd be there. I said, this is the hypocrisy within the media. And so the woman went on, did her story. Of course, need to say it was not complimentary. But she had a room full of witnesses to the truth, and she refused to, and she was from the New York Post. Why should any of us be surprised about any garbage that comes out of that publication? But the truth was still in the room. So how do you get the truth from the room out to the larger American public? How do you get the truth of a couple who had a healthy baby till vaccinated and now they have autistic baby? How do you get 2 million of those parents word out? Everywhere you go in America today, no matter what your truth is, if that truth in any way impinges upon the third rail of American industry, you're going to get electrocuted. Why? And for that, we have to go a little deeper into our system. And we can thank Chris Hedges for his meticulous research and, scholarship in helping us there. Because it's the first and deadliest salvo in the war on dissent. When do you think it happened? Well, it came in 1971 when Lewis Powell, does that name ring a bell? He was a corporate attorney. He had the same Lewis Powell that later became a Supreme Court justice. He wrote circulated a memo. Now, this was only among business leaders, and it was called Attack on American Free Enterprise System. And it became the blueprint for the corporate coup d'etat. Corporations, as Powell recommended in the document, pour hundreds of millions of dollars into the assault, financing pro-business political candidates, mounting campaigns against the liberal wing of the Democratic Party when it was actually a legitimately liberal wing, when liberal values stood for something and you could trust them. They also want to put money into the press. Today they own it. And creating institutions. Now, which institutions, in my personal opinion, are the most anti-human, anti-labor, anti-fair practice, anti-equality, anti-environment, anti-sustainable in America? Number one, the Business Roundtable, then the Heritage Foundation, then the Manhattan Institute, the Cato Institute, Citizens for a Sound Economy, the Federalist Society, and Accuracy in Academia. Boy, if there's an oxymoron, there's one. The memo argued that corporations had to fund sustained campaigns to marginalize or silence those, quote, in the college campus, the pulpit, the media, and the intellectual and literary journals, end quote, who were hostile to corporate interest. Think back. This is when Ralph Nader and I would write in the same publication, 1971, we wrote in Caveat Emptor together. And I would write on environmental issues. He also would do, and I'd write on health issues, the scam of different things. Well, it was Powell who attacked Ralph Nader by name. And lobbyists flooded Washington and state capitals. And regulatory controls were abolished. And massive tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy were implemented, culminating in a de facto tax boycott. And trade barriers were lifted, and the country's manufacturing base was destroyed. So if you want to know where did the jobs go and who opened the door and who made the deals, go back to 1971. That's when it started. Now, we think it was Ronald Reagan. No, it was before Reagan. Or we blame George Bush. No, that's long over. So the military budget, along with the organs of internal security, became ever more bloated. So if you wonder why today, as I mentioned yesterday, 57% of every dollar that we make in America as part of our gross domestic product goes to fund an absolutely unnecessary, dangerous, tyrannical, completely corrupt military-industrial complex, that's why. And by the way, for those of you who stand up and salute and say yes, yes, yes to our military, when was the last time that when you saw someone in a war zone, and they may have been injured, which is unfortunate, or killed, or they're just battered and they're clearly stressed, when did you juxtapose that? Not with someone today who's out there standing up against the military-industrial complex, but rather someone who was for spiritual, intellectual, or some higher reason stood up against at that time the draft and went to jail for it, or you were put on enemies list, or you were beaten in demonstrations. There was a big risk for being a part of the Students for Democratic Society and Berkeley campus and some of these other anti-war movements. So when we see someone in uniform, we assume that they immediately upon taking the oath and putting on that uniform have evolved into the hero status. But what is heroic when you occupy a foreign country's land, a country that has no way of defending itself, when women are raped, children are killed, people are droned, millions are displaced, depleted uranium is poisoning them, they no longer have anything representing a cultured or civilized life, there is no quality of life, corruption is massive, and they look back and all they see are the dead bodies. Now, mind you, in the Middle East, you have as many as 40 people in an extended family, aunts, uncles. So you kill a million people, you're impacting 40 million. That's 2 million more than even existed in Iraq. So everybody is impacted. And you don't think that from that negative impact and that occupation and that destruction and that corruption and that ethnic cleansing, you don't think that there's going to be blowback? Of course there will be. So where are the wise men and women? Well, what happens when you want to challenge that? You are considered a dissident, and dissidents are not to be given any form. They're to be attacked, marginalized, destroyed. Ralph Nader was one of the first. So when you find out that the military funded 10 corporations to do the same identical project, when only one should have done it, and even that one didn't need to do it. We didn't need it. Then you realize how powerful the private and the public partnership has become. We're a soldier in a foreign war, instead of having someone from their own army wash them their clothes, they have to pay Halliburton $100 for a bag, which should take a quarter to wash that duffel bag. And even then, the chemicals they use make everything toxic. But nobody questions it. Once it exists, it's as if it has a life of its own and it's allowed to exist unquestioned. So you have, in effect, a de facto blacklist, especially in universities and the press. And this was used to discredit all intellectuals who challenged, radicals and activists who decried the idea of a nation prostrating itself before the dictates of the marketplace and condemned the crimes of imperialism. And some of the best known, Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Sheldon Wolin, who we've had on this program, Ward Churchill, Ralph Nader, Angela Davis, Edward Said. These critics were permitted to exist only on the very extreme margins of society, outside of institutions. And many of them just had a hard time making a living. So the financial meltdown of 2008 not only devastated the global economy, it exposed the lies propagated by those advocating globalization. And among these lies that salaries of workers would rise, that democracy would spread across the globe, the tech industry would replace manufacturing as a source of worker income, that the middle class would flourish, that the global communities would prosper, all lies. But after 2008, it became clear that the free market is a scam. It's a zombie ideology. I believe personally that the entire University of Chicago Milton Friedman School should be closed, and in its place, they should have every brick taken off and then have social critics who are artists, then do a piece of art about how people around the world have been destroyed, the quality of their lives, their infrastructures, they're denied, the fact that we have 26,000 children dying of starvation or preventable diseases every 24 hours, regimes changed, global warming promoted, and every brick should represent a different story in what Milton Friedman and the neo-globalist, the neoliberalist, the people who believe in the New World Order, reconstruct the Milton Friedman Center at the University of Chicago and for the truth of it, of what it is. So you don't tear down a monument you disagree with. You recast it into its true light. Because there's nothing honest about neoliberalism. And that was a heart of it there. So all we have today is we have a zombie ideology by which workers and communities are ravaged by predatory capitalists, and assets are funneled upward into the hands of the global 0.1%. And the endless wars fought largely to enrich the arms industry and swell the power of the military. And by the way, when you're against certain issues, where was the liberal community in the last 8 years when Obama was president, of challenging the same statues? And by the way, to those who say tear down all the statues, if something about the person offends you, then as of today, you should have all the gays go out and tear down all the statues of Martin Luther King. He hasn't even a library. I've been down in Atlanta. Go and tear it down. Say, we're offended the fact that he did not support gay marriage. Let's see how long that lasts. The hypocrisy is palpable. You vote for Hillary Clinton, and she supports the man who throws gays off buildings and kills them. So as of this week, in Saudi Arabia, they're allowing women the right to drive. Ooh-ah, ooh-ah, wow-wow. But they're still going to kill gays. They may even crucify them, but only after they behead them. Kind of a wonderful part of Wahhabism. If you should get raped, if that same woman who now has the right to drive, if you should end up being raped, you, the victim, will be lashed up to 500 times and you'll spend 2 years in jail, and your rapist, nah. This is one of the most backward, Neanderthal, racist, sexist, violent, scumbag societies the world has ever seen. This is the Saudi Arabia. Oh, and by the way, right behind it, Egypt, and right behind it, Qatar, and right behind it, United Arab Emirates. You know, good luck trying to differentiate which one has the lower moral values. But the hypocrisy is when you vote for Hillary Clinton, and you also have to accept that with that vote comes the choices she has made and would make that would defy the very nature, the relationship of trust that you have given her. But don't wrap your mind too long around that. You may faint. So what we have is we have nothing but anti-intellectualism, anti-spiritualism, anti-common sense, anti-reason, and purely reptilian, limbic, reactionary minds. That's all we see. Deindustrialization is what we see. The very people who can't wait to get the latest chip in their arm or wherever, and the latest gadget, what if that new technology takes away your job? You still want to celebrate it? Because it's coming for you. Bankers, 30% of the entire financial industry will lose its job in the next 2 years. That's from head of Citicorp. So deindustrialization is on the move. But what are we replacing it with? What are we doing to educate, to create new opportunities, to put money into exchange a person from one job into another one where they still have a standard of living? We're not doing that, just like we didn't do with Puerto Rico, and that's why today there is absolute chaos. What would you do? There was a wagon train in the 1800s that took a wrong turn, which was not uncommon, and ended up not knowing how to survive off the land. They had not been trained. They were not adapted to that. So they ran out of food, and they killed their animals, ate the animals, and then ended up in cannibalism. We wouldn't know about it for the few survivors who were picked up. What are you going to do when you have nothing to eat? When you have no water to drink? When you have no medicine? You're diabetic, and you're taking your insulin. What happens when you have to take your blood pressure-lowering medicine? You're not living a holistic life, and there's no clinics to go to. There's no market to buy anything. There's no food. The water's gone. There's not even a rationing system, because it's not like you have 20,000 people who've been wiped out. You have 3.4 million people on an island that was deindustrialized so it could be first colonized. Remember, every citizen in Puerto Rico is a citizen of the United States. Get that straight. They are not a state, but they are protected territory. That means they have the same rights on almost all issues as an American citizen. So you would think that we would have had a massive FEMA effort. We had nothing. That's something we should pay attention to. It shows you the real value is only in what can be commodified. And human life is not part of that. So now we're left with nothing but austerity programs for impoverished working class and a fatally damaged overall economy. And the establishment politicians in the two leading parties, each in service to corporate power and responsible for the assault on civil liberties and impoverishment of the country, are no longer able to use identity politics and the cultural wars to whip up support. This led in the last presidential campaign to an insurgency for Bernie Sanders, which the Democratic Party crushed. And that's how you got elected. Remember, at the end of the day, it is John Podesta, and he'd be like Cardinal Richelieu if this were the Sun King's court. If you had John Podesta, Hillary and Bill Clinton, the people around them, their inner circle, they're directly responsible for electing Donald Trump because they're directly responsible for the attacks and destruction of Bernie Sanders. Barack Obama rode a wave of bipartisan resentment into office in 2008, then spent 8 years betraying the public. Obama's assault on civil liberties, including his use of the Espionage Act to prosecute whistleblowers, was worse than that carried out by George W. Bush. But Bush is, look, by any account, he's a buffoon. You know, but no, Obama was not a buffoon. Obama's a very bright guy. But he was bright and used his brightness like a scientist for Monsanto or an economist for Goldman Sachs or an energy engineer for ExxonMobil. He accelerated the war on public education by privatizing schools. He expanded the wars in the Middle East, including the use of militarized drone attacks, provided little meaningful environmental reform, ignored the plight of the working class, deported more undocumented people than any other president in American history, over 4 million. He imposed a corporate-sponsored health care program that was the brainchild exclusively of the right-wing Heritage Foundation. Why doesn't anyone on MSNBC, why don't they tell you this? Why am I telling you that it was the Heritage Foundation that wrote, along with the health industry, the insurance industry, that wrote it? No one in Washington, no legislator, even dotted anything. They just took what was given to them, but that's how it works. That's the pay to play. And we got a mess with that. And so they even prohibited the Justice Department from prosecuting the bankers and financial firms that carried out derivative scams, inflated the housing real estate market, a condition that led to the 2008 financial meltdown. He epitomized, like Bill Clinton, the bankruptcy of the Democratic Party. Clinton, outdoing Obama's later actions, gave us the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the dismantling of the welfare state, the deregulation of the financial services industry, and the huge expansion of mass incarceration. Clinton also oversaw deregulation of the Federal Communications Commission, a change that allowed a handful of corporations to buy up the airwaves. The corporate state was in crisis at the end of the Obama presidency. It was widely hated. It became vulnerable to attacks by critics it had pushed to the fringes. And most vulnerable was the Democratic Party, corrupt at every level. Everything about it was just putrid, was and is. Yet they claim to defend the rights of working men and women and protect civil liberties. A. When was the last time Hillary, Bill Clinton, or any of the other people of their ilk did you ever see outside of a campaign go into a poor neighborhood and say, I'm going to rent a house here instead of Martha Vineyard or taking over a house in West Palm Beach? I'm going to spend my summer here among the people that I say I love. I'm going to go to their restaurants. I'm going to hang out in their schools. I'm going to send my kid to their school and eat their cafeteria food. I want to get in line to get their health care so I can show them I really am like them. Now, name me one single scumbag, lowlife, degenerate politician. That's what I think of them, and I'm honest about it. If they don't like it, screw it. You're punks. Cowards. Show me one of those people that would go out and spend a month in prison incognito to see what it's like before they say people using marijuana should go to prison for 7 years. People who can't pay a bill should have a SWAT team raid. Let a SWAT team first take about 3,000 pounds of hormones each, look like Popeye, break into a door that was open, shoot a dog that was stuffed and dead in already, all so they can, what, go outside and yell and scream and high-five? What a sick society we become, where everything is masculinized in the man and woman. The alpha dog is everywhere. And it's not snipping at your heels. It's got its jaws around your throat. And that's the best I can say about our society today. So that's the Democrats. The Republicans are even worse. So there you have it. You have it where they are using the New York Post, MSNBC. They're using all of this to attack Black Agenda reports, Naked Capitalism, Truth Dig, Truth Out, Counterpunch, World Socialist website, alternate. Yeah, they're attacking them because they, along with their friend Jeff Bezos, I call him Bozo, the founder and CEO of Amazon. Oh, is that the same company? Just curious. They got $600 million contract from the CIA. Yes. And Google, likewise, is deeply embedded within the security and surveillance state in line with the ruling elite. Yes. And did Amazon recently purge 1,000 negative reviews of Hillary Clinton's new book to 5 stars from 2.5 stars back up to 5? Yes. Do corporations like Suck Up Google and degenerate Amazon carry out such censorship on behalf of the U.S. government? Yes. Is this censorship their independent contribution to protect the corporate state? Yes. And so that's what we have today. So you keep watching that media, you keep listening to those people, and you wonder why you can never find the truth, because it's not out there. So here we had Joan Shenton, and she saw people who were recovering. She saw people who have a life. Did you hear about it anywhere else? No. Oh, no. You did on PBS Tony Brown's Journal. You did if you read the Amsterdam News. You did if you attended Louis Farrakhan's lectures and sermons. You did if you listened to any of Stokely Carmichael's commentaries and Arthur Ashe's comments. Yeah. All across the American public, in the black community, everybody was hip to a natural approach to AIDS, and it didn't have to be a death sentence. Not a word anywhere else. That is the power of selective identity politics and censorship. Final postscript on that. Just the other night, I saw this 12.5-minute clip from Joan Shenton 30 years later. And it showed 5 people from northern Spain. One was a medical doctor. And these people all have been diagnosed with HIV positive and AIDS way back, 25 years ago. The only thing they had in common was not their politics. They weren't there to rant about, you know, AIDS or the politics in society. They were simply there to talk about the lifestyle they have lived that has allowed them to be completely healthy and disease-free. And particularly alarming was the medical doctor, because he said, I should have done my homework and I didn't. So they're all healthy, 5 people from the same area, all living a full life with no complications, and none of them took the drugs. Now, this was just a 12.5-minute clip. So she entered this, and it was accepted in some very prestigious film festivals, including one in Holland and 2 in England. And she put out a press release that the 5 people were coming in to be interviewed. Again, no politics, no challenging the AIDS community, the AIDS paradigm. They were just talking about what it's like to live a long, healthy life, living a natural life. Now, we're not talking about taking all the vitamins and the things that I would have someone do, or no, just normal life, de-stressing, etc. The sponsors told them at the last moment, in 3 festivals out of 3, we've had to decline your the invitation we gave you. Why? Because some AIDS charities are protesting it. Why? What are they protesting? All we're doing is having 5 people who've lived a long life using just a normal, healthy life and lifestyle. Nothing political. Why can't they talk about it? Okay, think for a moment. The only reason you wouldn't want that information to get out was you've been telling people all along, and you're controlling an $800 billion cumulative industry, more than heart disease and cancer combined, and a handful of small activists and groups. You've been telling them that, hey, it's a death sentence unless you take the drugs. And of course, the people giving you the money aren't the drug makers. That's censorship. That's the power of censorship. Now, tell me the last time you read a liberal journalist exposing the pain, profit, and politics of AIDS. Show me that one. Show me one. So you see, we don't only just have censorship of major issues, but we have censorship within those who've actually been censored. Isn't that the irony? It doesn't mean the truth doesn't exist. It means you got to look for it to find it today. I'm Gary Knoll. Didn't take a break today and didn't get to a couple issues, but I did share my commentary, part of it. And tomorrow, I'm going to go into the abuses in history, so to show you historical. And also, I was watching to see how Sean Hannity was going to handle a particular issue. And I believe he is sincere in what he says. But boy, when he starts off about praising America and our exceptionalism and, you know, our pioneers, and I'm sitting there, did Sean ever take a real class in history? Has he ever read Howard Zinn? Did he ever do his homework? So tomorrow, I will share with you the real history of the Wild West and how America was really founded. Now, I'm not even going to go back to the pilgrimage. That could be a separate discussion. I just want to talk about this whole idea of manifest destiny, how we believed that we had a right to conquer, and we did so with abandon. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Utrecht's Lead.